You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast, a show where normally two evangelical political theorists, progressive and a conservative, talk about philosophy, theology, and the political issues of the day. My name is Coyle Neal. I am an assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Our progressive is not joining us today. Instead, we have a special guest. Our guest is Jonathan Lehman, the author of a new book called How the Nations Rage, shortly to be released from and Jonathan, I should have checked this. Who's the publisher? Thomas Nelson, is that right?
Thomas
Nelson. Shortly to be released from Thomas Nelson. Jonathan Lehman is the general editor, is that right, of for Nine Marks editorial? You just told me this and I've already lost it. what is your job with Nine Marks?
Editorial director.
Editorial director. There we go. Not general editor.
Same idea.
Right. And host of the Pastor's Talk podcast with Nine Marks. Jonathan lives in Cheverly, Maryland with his wife. And how many kids are you up to now?
Four girls.
That sounds like you're very busy.
They're great.
And also an elder at Cheverly Baptist Church, a fairly recent church plant in Cheverly, Maryland. Thanks for joining us today, Jonathan.
Thank you, Coyle.
Well, why don't we start talking about your book on politics by talking about religion? Why don't you tell us just right off the bat, sort of what is the church, and then we'll use that to talk about the setting of the church within the political realm, and then we'll talk about how the church ought to be thinking about politics.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you want a short definition of the church, I would just say it's a group of Christians who jointly identify as followers of Jesus, through regularly gathering in his name, through preaching the gospel, and through celebrating the ordinances. That's just a short, you know, institutional definition of what it is. So you have several components to that. You have a group of Christians who gather and identify each other as Christians. They do this through the ordinances, and they do this as they preach the gospel. So it's just not a group of Christians. It's a ordered group of Christians, you could say. So that's the short answer. I can go on from there if you need me to.
Right. And I don't want to get too bogged down in what is the church, but I guess one question is what would distinguish the thing that you just described from something like a small group or a meeting of a fellowship of Christian athletes? Or any other number of meetings of people who would identify as Christians and agree with each other that they're Christians and share the gospel and so on.
Yeah, great question. A friend of mine was meeting in a house church in Shanghai, China, and he was sharing the gospel with a number of people who kept coming to faith, but they couldn't fit into his house church, so they all began meeting inside of his studio apartment there in Shanghai on a Wednesday night. And he was a very gifted and God-blessed evangelist. And so there was 5 people and then 10 and then 20 and then pretty soon 30 people who couldn't fit into his house church. So they came to his house on Wednesday nights for this Bible study. And they started to say, hey, we're a church. And he was like, no, we're not a church. And I'm not a pastor. I'm an engineer. And they said, no, we're a church. We get together. We sing songs. We open the Bible. You teach us out of the Bible. We're a church. And he kept insisting, no, I'm not. Well, long story short, they eventually decided to become a church. And yeah, that raises the question, okay, what's the difference between this Wednesday night gathering where people get together and sing songs of praise and open the Bible and learn and teach from it and a church? Well, the short answer is, moving from Bible study to church means stepping into an accountability structure. It means stepping out of a voluntary show up as you please group united around a common interest to identifying one another, going back to those, some of those elements I used in my definition that make a church. In other words, what's a Bible study? What's a bunch of people getting together and open a book that they're all interested in reading about? There's no expectation that you live a certain way, either there or apart. Suppose one person's, say, abandons his wife or is stealing from the office. You know, they're not going to say you can't keep coming to this Bible study. They can't, they're not going to say, hey, you're not, you don't call yourself a Christian and do that. Because in the Bible study system, there is no mutual accountability. There's no mutual affirmation. It's just people showing up for something that they're all interested in. Might as well be a chess club or a bike club or any other thing, right? Whereas when you step into a church, you and I share a common family name. You know, we baptize one another into the name of Christ. We take the Lord's Supper. And as we do that, we show that we're the church. 1 Corinthians 10:17, because there is one bread, because we partake of one bread, we who are many are one body, for we partake of the one bread. Meaning partaking of the bread is what reveals us as a one body. We're all Christians, right? And we affirm one another as Christians, Christians. That's what you do when you step into a church. You share in an identity, you share in an accountability, you share in a mutual affirmation, again, which we do through the ordinances. So it's not just a group of Christians, it's an ordered group or a covenanted group of Christians. That's going to be the difference. Does that answer your question?
Yeah. So it sounds like there's the biblical forms, right? The preaching the gospel, the administering the sacraments, and then there's the identity where you say we are a church. And then there's the accountability, right?
The ordinances, baptism, Lord's Supper, are affecting the identity and affecting the accountability. It's how you do that, right?
Right. We could keep talking about that, but we should move into the substance of the book. So the church exists at least in part in a political context, right? So there's not a church that exists outside of the context of some kind of nation state. I suppose short of places that have collapsed into utter anarchy. And how to think about that well is really the point of your book. You know, what does it mean to think about politics from a Christian perspective at the most basic level? Is that sort of a fair summary of what you're trying to do?
Yeah, well, in some ways, yes, at a conceptual level, that's what I'm trying to accomplish. But I'm also trying very pastorally to help Christians know how to engage and think about the public square, how to live. So my first book, Political Church, that was really the political theologian writing. This book, it's the half political theologian, political theorist writing, and half the pastor writing. So,
right.
So as I say it, at some point in the book, I'm trying to come alongside the Christian. So the subtitle is Rethinking Faith and Politics in a Divided Age. So right now, Christians and evangelicals around the country, world, I suppose, but especially around the U.S., are feeling a lot of angst over present divisions, divisions outside the church, divisions inside the church. Evangelicals especially seem to have a PR problem. You know, you talk about things like widespread support for Trump and how that's playing out in the culture, people bickering about that. So I'm saying, okay, brothers and sisters in Christ, what's going on here, right? We have a political problem, and we need to rethink that. So yeah, I'm coming as political theorist, but I'm also coming as pastor, and trying to help Christians in America think about the way forward. So at one point, I say in the book, in the introduction, my posture in this book is a pastor's. I want Christ's people to follow Christ in every area of life, including in their capacity as voters, office holders, lobbyists, editorial writers, jurists, and citizens. So this book is for Christians. Now, I hope that what follows does equip some readers to make an impact in the public square, and that all readers might know what it means to live peaceful and quiet lives. But we need to start with knowing who we are and being true to that identity. And then I go on just to say a Christian's political posture, in a word, must never be to withdraw as some recent literature would say. Our posture should not be to dominate, trying to bring heaven to earth. Rather, our posture is always to represent. And we do this whether the world loves us or despises us. We're going as Christ's ambassadors. And so I'm trying to help readers, Christian readers, understand what does it mean to be Christ's ambassadors in the context, living out of these embassies of our local churches in this present divided moment. So yeah, a lot of it's conceptual. Okay, let's think about faith and politics and their relation. But then it's, I mean for it to be practical as well. How do we move forward?
Well, and practically, how can I sit next to, you know, week after week after week in the church, someone who voted for that candidate?
Yeah.
I mean, we all know that, that person is just evil incarnate, and they support X, Y, and Z policies, that no Christian should ever reasonably support. And I know the person sitting next to me voted for him. Doesn't there come a point where maybe that's a matter for church discipline? I mean, should I continue to fellowship with that individual?
Yeah, I mean that's exactly the question that I think people are experiencing and feeling right now. So I remember during the 2016 elections, I got an email from a friend who said, "Look, we were having dinner with some friends from our church the other night. I offered a few of my thoughts on Trump. People got pretty mad. All this is crazy. I have to quit talking about the elections. They're really putting on a damper on our friendships. Too dangerous," this person said. Right? Meanwhile, the media is watching and saying, "Hey, look at that. Churches and evangelicals are splitting." So yeah, at the end of the day, it's in some ways, Coyle, you're exactly right. It's about the Lord's table. How can we sit down together as a family at the Lord's table and affirm one another when each side is convinced the other side is affirming injustice? So if you're a conservative, you're looking across the aisle and saying, "Hey, how could anybody have voted for Hillary and affirm abortion?" Meanwhile, progressive Christians, especially minority Christians, are looking and say, "How could anybody have voted for Trump and affirm the injustices of racism and everything else that he popularly represents?" I don't know how I can have fellowship with you. And so sure enough, just a couple of weeks ago, there was an article in the New York Times about how more and more minorities are leaving white evangelical churches. Well, we could have predicted that 2 years ago in 2016 when all this happened, or a year and a half ago. So yeah, it threatens the unity of the church. It threatens the credibility of the gospel and the witness of the church. So I think these are crucial matters. Whether you come down on the left or right, I think we can all recognize that these are crucial matters, thinking, okay, what is our relationship to politics and how should we posture ourselves there?
Well, and I want to start digging into the substance of the book, but one more sort of big picture question. Yeah. What if my view is that not just that the other side has gone too far, but that both sides have gone too far? So in 50 years ago, I think both political parties, both political ideologies were significantly more compatible with a Christian worldview, which is not to say that they were Christian, but they, the Democrats had not yet openly celebrated abortion at their national convention. The Republicans had not yet nominated as their candidate someone who I don't want to pick any one thing about Trump because there's a lot of things that they had not yet nominated Trump. Maybe I should just say that. How do you respond to the person who says, "Look, 50 years ago, Christians could sort of comfortably be on either side and have kind of a friendly, reasonable disagreement with each other. Now, both ideologies, both political parties have gone so far that there's no way a Christian can in good conscience fully endorse either of them. So it's time for a sort of strategic withdrawal." And of course, this is the Benedict option, right? This is time for us to unglue our hearts from this world and, still participate in the world, but realize that local communities, local churches, those are the things that matter most. And the rest of it can just sink into the ocean and that's fine.
Yeah, great question. I have to answer that at several levels. Number one, yes, 50 years ago might have felt better to you, Christian, if you're white, not sure your African-American brothers and sisters in Christ would agree with you.
Right.
Number two, I would say be careful about presuming Christianity overlaps precisely with any ideology. In fact, some of the things we're experiencing in the present moment, I would argue, come from widespread Christian assumption for not just decades, but centuries now, that the philosophy, political philosophy of liberalism did overlap neatly, nicely with Christianity. And in some ways, that gets us into the trouble we're in now. I think what we're experiencing now has not just decades, but even centuries old roots. So I'm not sure things were as great as you ever thought they were. Third, that instinct to withdraw, on the one hand, I'm sympathetic with it because no, our hope isn't in this world. And yes, we should be attending first and foremost to our churches. Absolutely, I agree with that. But the irony of that impulse to withdraw points to a closet utopianism that's been there all along. Namely, if things had been going better, we wouldn't have to withdraw. And you kind of, as a Christian, want to say, well, wait a second. Our hope has never been in this world. It shouldn't have been now. It shouldn't have been 50 years ago. It shouldn't have been 200 years ago. No, the political hopes of the church should lie first and foremost in Christ and in the life of the church. So where is it that spears are turned into plowshares, or rather swords are turned into plowshares and spears into pruning hooks? Where, in other words, do we first love our enemies? Well, it should be in the context of the local church. It's not the nation. It's not America that should be a city on the hill. It's the church that's to be a city on the hill. So 200 years ago, 50 years ago, today, the church is called to act as ambassadors. We're called to represent King Jesus. And as I said earlier in the interview, whether the world loves us, whether the world hates us, whether things are going well, not going well, our call is the same. So this instinct to withdraw, like on the one hand, it's getting some things right. On the other hand, it, as I said, points to the fact that we've been utopian and putting our hopes in the wrong place from the get-go. It's a multi-layered answer.
Right. Well, and obviously that utopianism may be an element of liberalism, sort of built into the DNA of it in any case.
So you may not be able to get away from it. I'm just saying be aware of the ideological pretensions of liberalism, and don't be hornswoggled by them. So liberalism has offered us many good things, various freedoms of this kind and that kind. And I think the good things that it's offered are those places where it does overlap with Christianity. At the same time, the danger of liberalism is that when it becomes an idol, when it becomes God, such that it's the all determiner of what's just and not just, like every other idol, it eventually turns on itself. And so a friend of mine, for instance, tweeted, there's a book out recently, which I've not read yet, but I'm supposed to read this week and review, called Why Liberalism Failed.
This is a Patrick Deneen's.
Yep, that's right. And a friend of mine tweeted, what freedoms do you want to give up, Patrick? Like, well, he's missing the point.
Right.
Unjust freedoms, those are what I want to give up. And just freedoms are the ones that I want to maintain. The problem is, liberalism doesn't allow you to define justice other than the fact that everybody has freedoms, in a sense. I'm oversimplifying here.
Sure.
In other words, I can't advocate for just freedoms and against unjust freedoms in a liberal system. And so
– yeah, we're straying from your book, but liberalism works very well in a culture that is dominated by a traditionally Christian ethic.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In a virtuous society, which is what Washington and Adams told us to expect.
Right. Well, or even going back, I mean, that's what, you know, John Locke and to some extent Thomas Hobbes and the original liberals had pointed out was, you know, we can do this because of the restraints that are built in by Christian, by religion. They didn't say Christianity necessarily, but of course that's who they were writing to. But once those go away, liberalism itself goes to its logical conclusion. And anyway, that's aside from your book. Jonathan, why do the nations rage?
It is, aside from my book, but in some ways it's in the background. It's underneath my book, and it comes to the surface in some ways in answer to your question. I begin chapter 2 by saying governments serve gods, right? Politics serves worship every time, all the time. The nations rage because we want to be God, or we want to serve our gods, however you put it, whether self-worship or worship of a false god, kind of the same thing. The nations rage against the Lord, and it is against his anointed, says Psalm 2, because the Lord and his anointed, the Messiah, Jesus, would say, I am king, I am judge. You're to bow down to me and live for my sake. So think of Jonah going to Nineveh, saying 40 days, there will be judgment. And gratefully in that story, the Ninevites repented. But most of us, when we hear that claim, judgment is coming, we say, forget you, God, right? And so we rage against the Lord and his anointed. And politics, in many respects, is the playing out of that. If I'm given charge over a vote or over a jury box or a courtroom or the presidency or any other thing, wherever I'm given decision-making authority, I'm going to use that for my own purposes, for the purposes of my worship, for the purposes of my gods, whatever those gods, whoever those gods happen to be, secular gods, Muslim gods, Hindu gods, progressive gods, whatever. I am going to use whatever decision-making authority I have, whether quote-unquote public or private, on behalf of my gods. And what's been difficult for Americans for a long time is we've seen our nation as a chosen nation, as if it were somehow exempt from Psalm 2. And what you find, my friend Trevin Wax put it well, Americans over age 45-50 tend to view their nation, our nation, a bit like as if it were Jerusalem or Israel. It's a chosen nation. Whereas Americans under the age of 45-50 tend to view our nation as Rome or Babylon. And in that regard, I personally went through a process a few years ago of sort of making that transition in my mind. I mean, I love the U.S. I'm a patriot in many ways. I love Aaron Copland. I love Walt Whitman. I love 4th of July. I love Grand Canyon. I mean, it's like in my heart, right? This is home. I love American cuisine. I love the flag. I love all of this stuff, right? That's deep in my heart in a way. Yet several years ago, I had this kind of emotional transition I went through where I realized, I'm not living in Israel. I'm not living in Jerusalem. I'm living in Rome. I'm living in Babylon. And America is one more nation raging against the Lord and against his anointed. And we as Christians need to recognize that we live in another city whose builder and architect is God. And we're awaiting this heavenly city. Now, that shouldn't make us love America less. In fact, recognizing that you love Christ more and you're a Christian more should make you love your nation more, but not idolatrously, not because it's the final be-all end of all things that you got to make perfect. Rather, you love it as you love any sinner, as it were, right?
Right.
Who needs to know God and the love of God and so forth. So I've completely lost track of your question, Kyle.
it was just why do the nations rage? You've answered, and I think your point that you made sort of at the beginning and at the end of your answer there is a good one, that this is a book that would not need to be written necessarily to a non-Western context, right? To any group of Christians, and there might be an exception, but nothing is springing to mind, but any group of Christians living in a nation outside of the liberal democratic Western tradition doesn't need to be told that the nations rage against God's people.
Yeah. And that's exactly, I mean, tell Christians in China that, right? They're like, yeah, of course. Tell Christians in Brazil that. Tell Christians in Russia that. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Right, which isn't to say I'm not dismissing the book. You know, it's a good book. It's just something that I hadn't thought about when I was reading through. But yeah, this really is a particularly Western problem tied into our history and into our utopianism and millenarianism and on and on and on. Once we sort of reorient ourselves a little bit to thinking about, and I know this isn't exactly your line of thought, but I think the phrase works. The fact that we live in two kingdoms, right? We live in the city of God, but we are, you know, pilgrims, residents, temporary residents in the city of man, in our, you know, the kingdom of this world. How then should we start to reconstruct a view of politics? You have several chapters dedicated to this, right? There's one on the Bible. There's one on thinking about the public square. One on the fallen human heart, and so on. So where do we begin, right? Once we've pulled ourselves away from thinking about America as God's nation, what do we put in its place?
Yeah, sure. In some ways, what I say in the book is there's two basic steps we need to take. Step one is recognizing that we need to be before we do. We as Christians, we as the church need to live as a redeemed nation before we think about redeeming the nation. Live as a changed world amongst ourselves before we think about changing the world. Right? Don't talk to me about, you know, your views on what's going on in the White House or what's going on in Congress. If you're not loving the brothers and sisters around you, practically, concretely, truly, real politics, you know, think of former House of Representatives Speaker Tip O'Neill, who said all politics is local. Well, I think he spoke more than he knew. So if I'm not locally loving my brothers and sisters, if I'm not locally caring for the people who God has placed in my path, you know, like the Good Samaritan, the person who's been beat up right in front of me in my path, in my church. If I cannot sit down at the Lord's Supper with somebody who voted differently with me, if somebody who's hurting and is in financial need in my church, somebody who's of a different ethnicity, somebody, any number of these things, then who am I to begin speaking about what's going on in the White House or Congress or the Supreme Court? So yeah, step one in the book in our reorientation coil is to be before we do. Step two is to recognize what the public square is when we step into it. And that's where I say very clearly, it's a battleground of God's where each one of us goes, as I was alluding to before, each one of us goes to represents our big G God or little G God. That's just what it is. Not only is that public square, not only can we not say the public square shouldn't be naked, that is to say bare of religious views or, you know, animating views of justice. Not only shouldn't it be, it can't be. It isn't. We all go there on behalf of our gods. And the view that the public square can in some sense be neutral at all is just a bluff. And I want to call the bluff on that. It's like a Trojan horse in a way. There's some of these gods hiding inside of that horse that we've wheeled into the city. So yeah, number one, recognizing that our political life begins locally and in our churches. And number two, recognize, so that in a way is where our hope needs to lie. And number two, that doesn't mean withdrawal from the public square. No, for the sake of love and justice, we're still to go into it. But when we go into it, we have to recognize what it is. And that is it's a contested space, and religiously contested space.
So it's, and this is one of the points you make in the Political Church book too. When we go into the public square, and let's say that we win the argument that it's contested space, like we get whoever the other side is in any particular discussion to admit, yes, okay, fine, none of us are really neutral. Should we then expect to win the debate that follows?
No, not necessarily. Not at all. And look, when you go into the public square, there's several different kinds of arguments that you're going to need to make. I call them the Luther approach, the Martin Luther King Jr. MLK approach, the sociologist approach, and then one more, the I can't think of it. Polycarp approach.
Right.
The first three are what you would call common ground approaches, right? I'm going into the public square and I'm trying to find common ground with people who have different gods, different worldviews than me. So the Luther approach, I'm appealing to conscience, right? So you have a conscience, you want it respected. I have a conscience, I want it respected. Let's agree not to violate one another's consciences. Okay? And that's common ground. And that's a fine argument to make in some matters. Or the MLK approach, kind of natural law, sort of universal principles we all agree to. I don't think that's a terribly effective argument these days. Nonetheless, if people want to try, I'm happy for them to try. Look, we all affirm equality, freedom, rights, so forth. Now, what gods are hiding in, who's equality, who's freedom, who's rights, that becomes more tricky. But nonetheless, like if you want to try the MLK natural law approach, great. The sociologist approach. Look, children raised in a home with two parents do better on SATs and there's less crime and less depression. And, you kind of go to the sociologist for statistics on human flourishing. You make those arguments, right? And I think all three of those common ground arguments are fine and sometimes even wise arguments to make. We shouldn't, just because the public square is a battleground of gods, doesn't mean we should give up looking for common ground. Of course we should look for it and try to win arguments when we find them. At the same time, we as Christians got to recognize that because it is a battleground of gods with no neutral religious space in it, we also have to be willing to make from time to time what I'm calling polycarp approach, which is basically taking after the second century bishop who was in the Roman Colosseum and asked by a Roman proconsul basically to deny his God. He wouldn't deny Jesus, who's cared for him these 86 years, says Polycarp. And the proconsul threatens him with the fire. And Polycarp says, oh, no, don't you recognize that you and I both stand before an even greater fire? That will one day come to basically anyone who denies God. In other words, Polycarp goes into the Colosseum. He goes into the quote-unquote public square, if I could put it that way, as a sectarian, right? He names his God, Jesus. And he says this Jesus, this God, actually has a claim not just on him, Polycarp, but on the Roman persecutor. And I think, recognizing that the public square is a battleground of gods means we have to be willing from time to time to say, look, you have your God, I have my God. I, in fact, think my God is God, and he makes a claim on both of us. And not only that, I think his way of living will lead to more flourishing in the here and now. It's good for later, and it's also good for now.
Well, what happened to Polycarp then at the end of that story?
He was burned at the stake.
Yes, but...
But little by little, Roman citizens began to take notice of all the Christians doing this, and Roman citizens begin to say, "My, there must be something here." See, the thing is, when you only make common ground arguments, it always works. It always seems better in the short term, but in the long run, what you're showing is that you're politically self-interested, and that there really is no final truth other than what each of us can adjudicate for ourselves. It sort of does away with God when consent and when the common ground argument becomes the be-all, end-all of political engagement. So again, I'm not saying we get rid of the common ground arguments, that we should stop looking for overlapping consensus, to use a politically loaded phrase, but I'm saying we need to add to it a willingness to say, hey, look, I actually think Jesus is Lord over everything, and even if you kill me or you take away my tax-exempt status, that's still the case, and this may not play well in the short run, but I'm playing for the long game here.
Right. Well,
so, yeah, we should expect to lose,
right,
to your question. Very briefly, we should expect to lose.
Not in the ultimate sense, right? I mean, we're going to heaven. There's that, but...
Well, or even in a long-term sense, I mean, in some ways, if you're looking at a perspective of centuries, things eventually went in Polycarp's direction. Not trying to say Christendom was victory when Constantine came along a few centuries later. Nonetheless, more and more people were persuaded by the way, the politics of these Christians who are willing to sacrifice everything for the sake of King Jesus. And it seems as if many conversions ensued.
Well, and I think the martyrdom story even explicitly says, yes, he was martyred, but look at all of these people who were converted as a result of that.
Yeah, that's right.
So what role? So we enter the public square sort of saying, yes, we are Christians. We're coming from a Christian perspective. We've got our toolkit of kinds of arguments we make. Where does the Bible fit into all of this?
Yeah, that's a great question. How do we read the Bible politically, right? That's something theologians and pastors and various political advocates have sort of been debating for years. And the way I answer that in the book is to say we need to view the Bible more like a constitution. It's the rule book for how to make the rules, right? Rather than actual case law or specific laws. In other words, you open up the U.S. Constitution, what do you find? You don't find tax laws, speeding limits, construction codes, right? Rather, what you find are the institutions, the establishing of the institutions who make those kinds of decisions and what the processes were for making those kinds of decisions. So what that means for us is if you're trying to figure out what to do with, say, immigration reform in the United States today, I'm saying, don't just turn to the Old Testament, see what God says about immigrants, and apply it directly to your situation as if the Bible was written for that purpose. It's not case law. You know, if you're trying to figure out how exactly do we combat abortion or what exactly do we do with same-sex marriage, well, the Bible doesn't present us a series of laws in that way. Rather, what it does is it sets up the institution of government and it establishes the jurisdiction of government. And it says what God has authorized government to do and what God has not authorized government to do. It's defined justice for us and the grounds and basis of justice, broadly speaking. Okay, so what we need as Christians is a biblical understanding of government and justice. And so in the book, one chapter is devoted to trying to do that, and another chapter, what government is, and its jurisdiction and its authority. And another chapter is devoted to this concept of justice. What exactly is justice, right? So think of it more as a constitution, less as case law. That's how I recommend approaching it.
Yeah, and I actually wanted to push a little bit on that, not because I disagree, but because I think it leads to some practical challenges. So you give the example in the book, and I don't know what page this is on because I have a proof, so I don't know what page it is. But in the chapter on the Bible, you talk about a government wanting to build a train from one city to another city, You have to go through these mountains, and it's very, very challenging. And the different ways you can do it, and one way is more expensive, but shorter, and one way is longer and easier to build. But and all these different factors go into it. And you basically ask, I've got the quote here. What's the biblical solution? Well, I'm not sure we can say there is one. We can say there are biblical principles we bring to bear on the question. But the answer finally depends on a number of complex calculations involving a host of moral and practical variables that requires wisdom. And I guess part of my pushback on that is, well, look, what does wisdom say, right? I mean, the train still has to be built. So, if we're asking a question about, say, gay marriage and what the law should be on that from a Christian perspective, the Bible provides practical wisdom, but we still have to choose one way or another. The Supreme Court chose for us. But assuming that we were working this out sort of democratically in our nation through our institutions, as a citizen, I would have to have some kind of vote on that. So are you saying there's not that kind of specific guidance available in Scripture?
In some ways, yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. It depends on the issue you're talking about. If we're talking about building train tracks and how to get from city A to city B, that's exactly what I'm saying. The Bible's not going to tell us, rather, as I put it in the analogy, should we go through the mountains where it's cheaper but more lives will be cost, or shall we go through swampland, marshland, where it's going to be more expensive but more safe, right, for the workers? Yeah, the Bible certainly does not, and no, we need wisdom for that. And when I say wisdom, What I mean is the Bible doesn't script the answer. Instead, what it asks us to do is to fear the Lord, consider different principles in play, and basically try to figure out what is wisdom in Scripture. Wisdom is two things. One, it's the posture of fearing the Lord. And number two, it's the skill of bringing order to reality, right? In that sense, engineering is wisdom. Mathematics is wisdom. Science is wisdom. Good policymaking is wisdom. Solomon was wise because he did all those things. He knew how to trade with the king of Lebanon. He knew how to build orchards and vineyards to bring flourishing to his society. In other words, he had wisdom in that he had skill in figuring out what this world is made of, what it's capable of, what people are capable of, and bringing order to it that benefited all. All of this under the fear of the Lord. So, yeah, in most policymaking matters, no, the Bible does not script them. In fact, it calls human beings to exercise their agency, to exercise the dominion God gave us. What does it mean to be created in His image? Well, it means we're to rule. We're to act like He acts in bringing dominion to creation and using the wisdom God has given us to do that, right? So most of politics, quote unquote, in the public square, is not biblically scripted, but is the domain of wisdom. One more Solomon example. You know, the two prostitutes come, each saying, "That's my baby." "No, that's my baby." Solomon says, "Bring me a sword. I'll cut the baby in half and give half to each." And the real mother says, "No, no, no. She's the mother. She can have the baby." And then Solomon's like, "Yeah, okay. Now we know who the real mother is. It's you." And then verse 28, 1 Kings chapter 3 says, "And the people were amazed that God had given wisdom to Solomon to do justice." Right? There you have the political philosophy of the Bible in a single verse. We need the wisdom of God to do justice. Think about Solomon there for a second. He had to figure out what to do in this unscripted scenario. Okay, I got this woman. I got that woman. What do I want to do? Well, I know I want to do justice. That's an absolute, right? Bible has given me justice. There's a call, the demand to do justice. Okay, but how do I do it here? And yeah, that's where we pray the Lord and we grow and learn and study and have conversations, whatever our policy field is, and get better. And this is where non-Christians, frankly, can even be quote-unquote wise and sometimes even out-competence Christians. So we need to ask lots of questions, whatever our field is. So that's the call to wisdom. Now, you use the example of same-sex marriage. Well, there actually, I think we're getting into the issue of what God has or has not authorized governments to do. I would say He has authorized governments to do justice, to whoever says the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, to, you know, Romans 13, punish those who do wrongdoing. He certainly has authorized governments to affirm marriage. You see that in, I think, Genesis 9. What He has not done is authorized governments to redefine marriage, to rewrite marriage, I would say He's not given government the authority to declare two men husbands such that they can then take a child that's conceived by a woman and call that child as if it belongs to those two men, which I would say is a kind of almost kidnapping, government-sanctioned kidnapping, or could be in certain situations. That child, before God, has been given a mother and a father. But now we, for the sake of fulfilling a certain social agenda, say, no, we can use, you know, a surrogate mother, or we can whatever, and basically take that child from its mother and give it to these two men who claim to have the right to do so. And ironically, put the rights of these two men way ahead of the rights of the child, which to me is amazing. Nobody ever asks questions about the rights of children in that way. I understand adoption situations are a little different, but I'm just thinking, say, in the situation of surrogacy. All that to say, I don't think God has given government the authority to do that. In fact, God promises that He's going to judge such injustices. And so that's where I would say a Christian should never put his or her hand to that which will bring in the justice of God or the judgment of God. So yeah, But even there, Coyle, okay, how do we do that? Well, that's going to take a lot of how do we advocate for these things in the public square with people who disagree with us? What policies do we oppose or fight against or not? I mean, all of that's going to take wisdom as well. But the basic posture there, I think, is clear for a Christian.
Well, and that's a good segue into sort of the next section of the book. If God has not given government the authorization to, you know, redefine marriage, what has God given the government authorization to do? What's what is its job?
Yeah, right. And let me say this: the political scientist Robert Bennett, and I quote this in the book, I think has put it well. He says you have straight line issues and you have jagged line issues. Straight line issues: there's a straight line between the biblical principle or command and the policy application. So you shall not murder, biblical principle, pretty straight line. Most Christians would agree to, you know, abortion is wrong. You don't have to go through a lot of logic to move from one to the other.
Right.
Whereas other issues are what you might call jagged line issues. And where you have to make multiple turns and between one implication and another implication, this principle combining with that principle, it's a more complex process. So what's the quote unquote Christian position or quote unquote biblical position on healthcare or tax policy or education policy? Well, those are jagged line issues. And, I think on straight line issues, we as Christians can speak more directly from Scripture. And on jagged line issues, I think we as Christians need to respect Christian freedom and allow one another to disagree and so forth. So what is the government's job? What, in other words, is sort of a straight line issue? Well, I think the beginning of that is Genesis 9:6. You know, so back in Genesis 3, you have, or 4, you have Cain killing Abel. And now in Genesis 9:1, God repeats the mandate he gives to, or the commission he gives to Adam, but now he's saying it to Noah, be fruitful and multiply. So he's repeating the dominion mandate, but now we're post-fall. So he puts a justice mechanism in place to keep the Cains from killing the Abels. So he says three times, I require whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. In other words, for man was made in God's own image. In other words, every one of you is made in my image. Every one of you is worthy of dignity and honor and respect. And therefore, to transgress that is going to incur a penalty, a kind of a like-for-like penalty, one for one, life for life, not life for healing, you know, stealing a horse, not life for false worship, but life for life, stealing for stealing, and so forth. So he builds in this equity producing justice mechanism, right? Based on the fact that we are all created in God's image. Romans 13 is the more common text Christians go to, but I think all of that's grounded. That in a sense is commentary on the authority God sets up in Genesis 9. And what's wonderful about the authority in Genesis 9 is it applies even to the government. It applies against abusers, government abusers. So ask yourself the question, you know, does whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, does that apply to Hitler? Well, of course it does. Hitler's under that. Every dictator is under that. Every scene of police brutality is under that. Dirty cops are under that. Government is not above that because it comes from God. So what you have in Genesis 9 is you might say, three basic functions of government. Function one is the rendering of judgment in instances of injustice. And there you might also say preventing injustice. So if certain policies are producing injustices or could produce injustice, I think that's within the government's domain. Certainly you get foreign defense in that. If an invader is going to come and rape and kill and pillage our people, I think this is the authority to defend ourselves against such pillagers and rapers and so forth. So number one is rendering judgment for the sake of justice. Two, and I've already sort of floated into this, I think it's building a platform of peace, order, and flourishing, right? So it's all set within the dominion mandate, be fruitful and multiply. Well, why do we have the justice mandate, a mechanism? For the sake of facilitating peace and order. In other words, justice exists so that we might live untrammeled, unhindered, unmolested lives of peace and flourishing, and for humanity to continue, and each person to do what each person is going to do until they threaten to harm or could harm another, until injustices get in the way. So that's a second function. And then a third function, I would say, is to build a platform of salvation. That's going to sound unexpected, perhaps.
Especially from a Baptist.
what you have is Genesis 9 before Genesis 12 and the call to Abraham. I can't get to church if I'm bludgeoned by bandits on the way, right? I can't love my neighbor as myself if my neighbor's trying to kill me or another neighbor's trying to kill me. In other words, doing the work of salvation. And then Paul says exactly like this in First Timothy 2. He says, pray for those in governments and authority. I'm doing this from memory. That we might live peaceful and quiet lives, for God desires that all people come to salvation. Why should I pray for governments and kings and authorities? So that I can live the kind of life that allows people to come to salvation. In other words, the state exists ultimately to serve the purposes of salvation, to serve the purposes of the church. So that's an ultimate purpose. Its immediate purpose is to render judgment and to provide peace and order to our lives. That's what God has authorized it to do. And then we could go into different, I can give you more texts in the Old Testament where we see that playing out.
Well, I'm glad you phrased it that way, because I was actually going to ask you in the book. I don't think you mean it quite the way it sounds in the book. But when you talk about that third function, I've got a quote here. We don't want a government that thinks it can offer redemption, but a government that views its work as a prerequisite of redemption for all citizens. And I guess my pushback at that particular phrasing has been, you know, answered by your statement. Because the government may not necessarily be aware of what it's doing, right?
And that's right.
A prerequisite for salvation. The language in the book itself sounds sort of, the government is conscious and it's trying to do this. You know, it's trying to set up conditions such that people can be converted to Christianity. And yet that would run counter to the nations raging against us. Rather, that the government ought to be pursuing peace and justice, and a stable enough lifestyle that we can do things like evangelize because there's order in society and because, you know, we're not currently being invaded or bandits aren't roaming the countryside or whatever.
Yeah. Well, there's a very real tension there, isn't there?
Right.
Like on the one hand, you have Romans 13, which presents a positive view of government. And on the other hand, you have Psalm 2, which presents a negative view of government. On the one hand, you have Nebuchadnezzar after he's been humbled. There's basically two kinds of governments in the Bible, in a sense. Those who understand or at least mean to be serving the Lord and his anointed. So whether consciously or unconsciously, so Nebuchadnezzar after he's humbled, you know, has this wonderful statement that God is God and no one shall stay his hand and he does all that he pleases, and he perceives and then he protects Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He protects them for good purposes. So I think a government can be conscious of, and to the extent that it is conscious of, serving the Lord and providing that platform, I think that's a good thing in defining justice as God would have it. Then on the other hand, you have governments, or another positive example would be Cyrus. Though Cyrus doesn't know it, he says, though you, Isaiah 45, though you do not know me, you are my, interestingly, he is his servant, he is his Messiah. Cyrus is this Persian king who doesn't know the Lord, but he's doing God's purposes. On the other hand, you have those who are explicitly set against the Almighty. So you have Pharaoh, who is the Lord, that I should obey him, he says to Moses, or the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, right? They're explicitly against the Lord. So I don't think a government has to be against the Lord or unconscious of what it's called to do. In fact, I would say it, to the extent it can, and certainly to the extent Christians go into the public square, they're going to be conscious of that. And that is a good thing. Nonetheless, we do know that in history, the nations rage against the Lord and explicitly oppose him. And sometimes, because God is so big and mighty and strong, as the song was in Sunday school, my God is so big. So he can use even those who oppose him. Think of Pharaoh, right? Herod and Pontius Pilate. He can use those who oppose him to accomplish his good purposes.
Yeah, and that's actually a question that I wanted to get to in the last chapter of the book. Before we jump into that, anything from, you know, the first bits that you wanted to bring out?
No, I'm slightly tempted to sing that song again, but
man, I haven't heard that since I was probably 7 or 8.
God is so big, so strong, and so mighty. There's nothing that my God cannot do. You remember that one?
I do. That that takes me back to, golly, I don't even know.
We could sing it together, Kyle.
We could, but we're not going to. As an act of common grace and to clear the ground for salvation of others, I will not sing that song right now.
All right.
So towards the end, and this does tie into what we're talking about with the function of the church. The function of the state is sort of clearing the groundwork, which I think that's something Kuyper talks about, right? In his lectures on Calvinism and the lecture on politics, he talks about politics as a sort of groundwork for all of the other spheres, right? It's the sphere that overlaps at least to some small extent with every other sphere, because you have to have the state in order before science can do its thing, and before art can do its thing, and before the family and even the church can live the way they're supposed to live. And you talk about this a little bit in your final thoughts in the chapter just called Final Thoughts, about God's common grace. When you say, God's common grace grants many a nation better than it deserves, but I have little confidence that America will long remain strong, prosperous, and free without any concept of God's righteousness and justice somewhere in the background. Not because I believe in a civil prosperity gospel, obey God, the nation will be blessed as his chosen people. It's because I believe the way of God's righteousness and justice is the way of wisdom, and prosperity and flourishing ordinarily come to the wise. The nation can be strong apart from God's righteousness, like a totalitarian state is strong, or it can be free in some impoverished and mangy sense of that word, like a stray dog is free, but it won't be both. So again, I guess there's that. My question is about whether or not that has to be a sort of conscious knowledge of this thing we're doing is, you know, what we find in the Bible, or is that a nation pursuing God's righteousness? Is that something that is available still through common grace, but available, say, to, you know, a non-Western nation that doesn't believe the Bible at all, but is still trying to pursue justice to a nation, say, governed by, a Muslim leadership, or by atheist leadership, or communist leadership, or you know, pick your non-Western system of choice. Do they have to have that conscious knowledge of the wisdom of God's word in order to achieve those effects, or is common grace sort of wide enough for everyone in that specific sense?
Hypothetically. Certainly, God's common grace is wise enough to, he causes the sun to shine on the just and the unjust, right? So absolutely, you can have a just government that is completely oblivious to the Lord and his anointed. Nonetheless, insofar as people stray from the knowledge of God, they are often going to stray into injustice. So again, how do we understand justice in the Bible? You have to understand it covenantally, which is to say there's a justice that's associated with God's special covenant. This is new covenants. And there's also a justice associated with the common covenant given to Adam and Noah. Again, let me take you to Genesis 9:6. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall blood be shed. For God made man in his image. Now think about the tensions in that verse. On the one hand, it does not authorize us to prosecute crimes against God. It doesn't authorize us to prosecute false worship. Rather, to prosecute something, there has to be harm to a human. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. Again, there's parity. You can't measure a crime against God. You can't recompense God, right, for your false worship or your blasphemy. So here in 9:6, on the one hand, I want to say you have the beginning of the religious tolerance, right? And anybody can accomplish that, whether they believe in God or not. On the other hand, and here's the tension, what's the grounding for this justice mechanism? For God made man in his own image. Justice is grounded in the fact that all human beings have been created in God's image. So for me to do justice to a human being, I need to know what a human being is. What is a human being? Somebody made in God's image. Why should I not do harm to another human being? When we talk about giving someone his due, what does a person do? Well, they're due whatever it means to be made in God's image. So I can't define the human unless I have a view of God. I can't define justice unless I have a view of God. So get rid of your view of God get rid of your view of what it means to be made in God's image, you're going to have a distorted anthropology, and therefore you're going to have a distorted view of justice. So you use the Muslim example. Well, why are foreigners treated as second, third, fourth class citizens in Muslim countries? Why are women treated so poorly? Well, because there's not a strong concept of man and woman being created in God's image. So yes, hypothetically, in answer to your question, those who depart from God or don't know God or don't name God can have, by God's common grace, just governments, just systems. And sometimes I think God allows those to endure for a season or maybe even a long season. On the other hand, if you just look throughout history, find me a nation, find me a tribe, find me a people who is pagan or believed in some false worship, who sustained a view of human rights or human equality or the notion that all people are worthy of dignity and honor. I think you're primarily only going to find it in Christian-ish, Christian-impacted countries. So, yeah, I kind of stick to what I wrote there, which is the more our nation moves away from the knowledge of God and so forth and explicitly denounces them, I fear the more injustice will begin to characterize what we experience in this country. That may not be right. Who knows? The Lord does as he pleases. I'm not a prophet.
Well, and I want to use that then to go all the way back to the beginning of the interview and ask, all right, well, look, okay, fine, I agree with you. You know, the only true justice is found through a proper knowledge of the Lord, which is only found in Scripture and only truly held, although not perfectly held by believers, by Christians. So then kind of back to that original set of questions, why shouldn't I want to see Christians, you know, rise up back into power in Western nations or non-Western nations for the first time, if that is the case may be, and take over and bring sort of Christianity back to America or back to England or back to France or Norway or, you know, not back to, but for the first time to China or Japan or Iran or whatever. Or alternatively, why shouldn't I say as a Christian, look, the only place you're going to get true justice is from Christianity, and our culture has so utterly rejected it that it's not realistic to say it's going to be coming back anytime soon. So we're going to Benedict option our way out of here.
Again, because we're not called to either. What has God authorized us? What has He called us to do? Well, He has not called us to enforce our religion. He's not given us either the power or the authority to enforce our religion by the sword, right? So we're not authorized to prosecute false worship. We're incapable of causing the heart to be born again with the sword. Now that was one of the errors of aspects of Christendom, right? Thinking that Charlemagne going into a German tribe saying convert to people with, you know, holding a sword to their throat could make them actually convert. Well, that's ridiculous. We're believers in the new covenant. We know that only the Spirit can cause people to be born again. So because we think we're neither authorized nor competent, able to enforce Christianity or to enforce conversion.
Well, not conversion, but right, civil law is what we're talking about.
Well, civil law. Yeah, no, well, let me one step at a time. So I'm not going to try to overtake the state on behalf of the name of Jesus. All that's going to do is produce heretics and hypocrites. That's the church's job. It's the church's job. It's been given the authority to evangelize and make disciples. So let's give that job to the church and not to the state. Now, when it comes to defining the state, I'm called to do justice to my neighbor and love my neighbor as myself. So yeah, insofar as Christians can step into positions of political power, whether just as an ordinary voter, a lawyer, in Congress, I think that's a good thing to do, and that's the calling of some. It's not the calling of all. It's going to be the calling of some to go in and seek to love our neighbor as ourselves and to do justice as God defines just as just, not as John Rawls defines it, not as Nancy Pelosi defines it, not as Hare Krishna defines it, but as God defines. There's only one view of justice, and that's the one we get from God. And so the Christian entering the public square for the sake of doing justice, which we're all commanded to do, we should. That's why we shouldn't withdraw. That's why I'm opposed to the withdrawal notion, but I'm opposed to the utopian going and dominate and overtake things notion, because again, we're not authorized to do it and we're not competent to do it. So if you want to pull me, in that sense, I'm going to resist trying to be pulled into a ditch on this side of the road or the ditch on that side of the road. Right in the middle of the road, I'm going to say we're called to represent. We're called to love our neighbor as ourselves. Churches should do their jobs. Governments should do their jobs. And we as believers, whether we're a pastor or a politician, are called to represent King Jesus. Am I answering your question?
Yeah. So again, in not speaking in terms of salvation, right? So just talking strictly civil society stuff, you're saying that Christians are supposed to live with the tension of, you know, God having the way that a society will be orderly, free, just, protect rights, on and on and on, but not authorized to forcibly impose that on society.
Well, not forcibly impose worship.
We're not talking worship. We're talking kind of the cultural matter of the state, right? So you don't have to admit that God is king, but you do have to admit that you shouldn't, or you do have to obey the law, not to murder, not to steal, not to do all of these things that, again, the Christian ethic holds to.
Yeah, and let's be clear, that's for me to argue not to murder, not to steal, is an imposition of my religion.
Yes.
It happens to be the imposition of most people's religion, gratefully.
Right.
But it is an imposition of religion. It's not like an a-religious view. It just so happens most of us religiously believe that it's wrong to murder and steal. So I'd be careful not to use the language, we should never impose our religion, because we're all doing that all the time. That's what politics does. That's what government does. It imposes someone's moral worldview. It imposes someone's religious worldview. It just can't do otherwise, right? What's unique about Christians compared to everybody else, Coyle, is that we actually have a doctrine of separation of church and state. We have a doctrine that says, okay, all those religious views of yours, Jonathan, Coyle, such as Jesus is king, Jesus will come again, even certain ethical views like sex outside of marriage is wrong, you're not allowed to impose that on all people. You're not authorized to impose the fact that believing that Jesus rose from the dead is truth. You're not allowed to impose that on other people. In fact, you have to keep that quarantined to your church. Now, what about the regressive non-Christian? What keeps them from imposing the entirety of their religion on us? Nothing. There's no separation of church and state for the person who doesn't believe in God or the state or the church. In other words, when the non-Christian says, hey, separation of church and state, what they mean is separation of my church from the state. There's no such thing as a separation of idolatry in the state. They're more than happy to impose their idols on me. So the separation of church and state, ironically, applies exclusively to Christians. Maybe you could say to Jews and other people of organized religion, Muslims. But those who don't believe in an organized religion kind of get off scot-free. They're allowed to impose whatever they want to impose. Those of us who believe in organized religion, ironically, have to pull certain things back and not work to impose them on others.
Yeah, so there's a voluntary restraint on our part, right? And I guess that's what pushing at a little bit is again this idea of, well, let's take something like marriage. So as a Christian, I'd say I believe in traditional marriage of a man and a woman, where divorce is only for very limited reasons, right? I do not believe in no fault divorce. So as a Christian, I'm going to say, look, our society would be better, healthier, more free, more prosperous, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, if it were to codify this belief into the law,
mm-hmm.
right? If it were to change its laws from our current laws that allow no-fault divorce to laws that that do not allow it. Now again, the question is
you're making common ground arguments there. Flourishing.
Well, right. Again, however, right. But to some extent, do I even care if people agree with me, if it's better for them, mm-hmm. right? If their lives are better, if this law is put in place, am I obligated as a Christian to say, all I can do is make the argument and I just, either the world will be convinced or it's not, or is it obligatory on me as a Christian to try to do more than that and say, no, look, I'm going to do my best to compel the world to follow this rule because it is good for them, because it will lead to results that they want, even if they don't like the means.
Well, there's not an easy yes or no to that. Can I compel? I mean, it's possible that by compelling, I mean, it depends on what my circumstances are. Like, am I the king or am I just one more voter?
Supreme Court Justice, you know, or, yeah, I mean, obviously there's
I mean, the question is, do I commit other injustices by compelling people to do something, or do I not commit other injustices? So if I'm the king, yeah, I'm happy to define marriage as belonging to a man and a woman. Absolutely. Because I don't think A, because I don't think I have the authority to do otherwise. B, because I do think it's good for people. C, I think I'll be vindicated on the last day by the Lord. But I can imagine another set of circumstances where compelling people to do something that they're opposed to is a kind of injustice on its own. It's going to commit other acts of violence. And so, you know, okay, here's an example. Say fornication. What I want to criminalize fornication and just sex outside of marriage. In order to enforce that, it's conceivable that I, like, on the one hand, I think it would be better for society if nobody ever fornicated, right? It's kind of in a hypothetical, scenario. It'd be better for everybody. Nonetheless, for me to actually enforce a no fornication law might require invading homes and creating so much social unrest at this point in redemptive, at this point of history, that I would have to do a great amount of violence in order to secure that kind of ideal end. In other words, when I start to over-legislate a full Christian morality, it's probably because, as in Christendom, I have a certain false, over-realized eschatology, where I think I'm responsible for bringing heaven to earth now. And the problem with overrealized eschatologies, which is the way theologians call it, or political philosophers call it, utopias, the problem with those is they always create injustice. They always lead to violence. Not always. They often do, right? And I think we need to be very aware, very cautious about over-legislating everything the Bible would say is right and good. I don't think government is called to do that.
Yeah, and that's something that I've been kind of thinking about a little bit. You and I both come from a tradition that appreciates the Puritans a lot, right? But that appreciation, especially with us as Baptists, that appreciation basically stops at the door of their political views. And it ties into what you're writing with this book, because they have very set political views that involve things like revolution and executing the king and setting up a republic run under Christian principles and so on. And I'm not advocating for that in the United States for many, many, many reasons. But it does beg the question of, well, if we're not supposed to be doing that, what are our obligations? Like, what ought Christians to be doing? What level of involvement should we have? How much should we be pushing our worldview? How much should we be just proclaiming our worldview and not worrying about things like actual real world enforcement, right? How much should we proclaim no fornication to the world and then only enforce it within our local church and let the world follow or not, versus how much should we know? We have Christians who are members of the state legislature, so let's have them propose that bill. You know, and that it's that balance that I'm kind of hoping to work through at some point. And I think your book's pretty helpful on that. Sorry, that's me kind of rambling a little bit there.
Well, and I would just say right now, the first questions I think Christians need to consider in this country, at least, is back to what I said are the two things. First principle, be before you do. So judgment begins with the household of God, Peter says in 1 Peter 4. Let's think about right now, let's think about our local lives together. Are we living justly and righteously? And I think Americans, Christians in America would do well to turn their attention there.
Right, which obviously there are some deeply unhealthy churches in America that need to be dealt with long before we can start worrying about the ills of society. Well, Jonathan, anything else you want to mention out of this? I know we're coming up on time for you. So any last thoughts on nations raging?
They sure do. No, brother, thank you so much. It's been a fascinating conversation. And I pray my answers have been elucidating and useful.
They have certainly been both of those things. And thanks for writing this book. I look forward to the final copy. I've got my galley copy here, but I always like to have the real deal.
Awesome.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of the City of Man podcast. We're a part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. You can find out more about our show or other shows on the network at christianhumanist.org. Please do stop by the iTunes page and give us a review to help others find the show. You can also check us out at Facebook, on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or send us an email directly at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks again to Jonathan Lehman for joining us. Do check out his book, How the Nations Rage. And on behalf of Ed Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. I went a walk in that ribbon of high